Time to take a look at hybrid vehicles, diesel, and fuel technologies with Glenn Bauer. Glenn's a senior scientist in mechanical engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. We're really pleased to have him with us today to talk about all things hybrid and diesel and all those fuel technologies that are out there. And certainly, if you have some questions as we move along today, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Glenn, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry.
You know, Glenn's got on his University of Wisconsin shirt here. It's nice, bright red. And that reminds me about a story he was talking about relating to what's called the Bucky Wagon. And talk a little bit about I've enjoyed that Bucky Wagon for years. We haven't seen much of it, though, in the last few years.
That's correct. The athletic department was the owner for quite a few years, and it was started that it actually took the crew hauls back and forth between the lakes, and then it migrated into actually taking the football team to the train station and back, and that was back in the early 1900s. And since that time, after it got retired from that, it was when my memory as a kid going to Camp Randall, the football games, is all the cheerleaders and Bucky was on it.
Yeah.
Came screaming in kind of that north end zone, and then they all jumped off and did their cartwheels and everything. Unfortunately, through the parades, being it was a manual transmission, the transmission case on the Bucky Wagon is split in half, and there are no parts for it. It's basically it's a LaFrance fire truck, but it was built on a Chevy platform, and it's a 1932. So between the engineering department and the Alumni Association, which is currently basically the owner of the Bucky Wagon, we are just starting a campaign to basically Wisconsinize kind of the monster garage type redo, kind of the Bucky Wagon into a newer version. And we're talking to the people in the Detroit section who are actually talking about even making it electric or a hybrid.
Wow.
And one of the things we want to do then is, it can't go on to Camp Randall. And so if we make it electric and seal everything up, then there's no fluids that can be dropped, no fuel on board. The idea is then we might actually have the option of taking it right onto the field like it used to do in 50 years ago.
Well, it wasn't that long ago. It was only 4 or 5 years ago that I remember the Bucky Wagon coming out, or maybe.
Yeah, but it stops like at the end zone line. Yeah. It's not allowed to go onto the field. So we're trying to make it so we actually can drive it on the field. And my way out there thought is if I could put an elevated stand on this that goes up pneumatically, I might get Mike LaCrone to use this as his conducting platform for the halftime shows. He's into gadgets and all.
He surely is. Anybody who's ever been to their spring concert knows that. He loves gadgets. Well, so if anybody wants to throw in their 2 cents worth on that, they're certainly welcome. But if you have a question about the hybrid electric vehicles, the diesel, the fuel technologies, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And I've already mentioned a couple of times on the program, and I almost hate to bring it up again, but I will because the topic is relating to hybrids. Toyota's got the 2010 hybrid Prius out. A little bigger than its predecessor. It's a little more powerful, more fuel efficient. Certainly, I think more luxurious and more refined. Renee and I purchased one a few weeks back, and I've been driving it around and drove it to the great fest last weekend or last Friday up at Custer, Wisconsin, so the energy fair, and got, I don't know, 55, 56 miles to the gallon on it. It's a great car, I think.
Yes, all the new hybrids look to be doing very well in the fuel economy categories. I actually did a lot of research this morning getting ready for this and looked at it. The winners are the people that do more of the urban driving where you do a lot of stop and go. Those are the cases where you're actually really seeing the fuel economy increase over the baseline models and usually on the order of 2 times better fuel economy.
Yeah, I think it was about 80 miles to the gallon driving from home to work. And it's all in town, so you're hardly ever get the gas engine hardly ever turns on. So it's pretty amazing, that's for sure. Well, Dennis in Appleton's got a question or comment, so let's go to Dennis. Hi, Dennis.
Hello. I just wanted to say that as long as what I hear is we only have 3% of the world oil supplies in the United States, the continental United States, that we don't ever want to be dependent upon an oil. And I just wanted to say that back in the 70s, when I got out of high school, I drove vans for the local paper up here, the Post Crescent, and we would have a where we could switch to compressed gas or use gas. And I drove for 3 years, and I could, when you were on compressed gas, you couldn't tell the difference. But the difference is now is that where I used to fill up, they don't even have a tank anymore. You think that if we would have continued with the idea, probably under Jimmy Carter, of putting tanks in and really pushing it, that compressed gas would have ever worked, or was there something wrong with that?
There is absolutely nothing wrong with compressed natural gas. The United States actually has a fairly large reserve of compressed natural gas. And foreign countries like India, the bigger cities, everything in the city has to be run on compressed natural gas. And so it's just a matter of developing the infrastructure. The only one thing we have to do as a country is we need to look at the whole energy spectrum. Compressed natural gas or natural gas itself, you don't have to compress it that far. Obviously, if you use it in your household as basically for water heaters and for heating the homes in the wintertime. And so we want to be careful that we don't jump too quickly and convert, you know, try to say we're going to convert all of our gasoline engines to compressed natural gas, and all of a sudden it becomes a high-cost item. And at that point in time, then people can't afford to heat their homes. And so we have to advance very, very
carefully,
carefully in this situation.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Dennis. Appreciate it. Mark in Madison, on to you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys. I'm just calling because I have a diesel a vehicle. I've owned a diesel Jetta for about 8 years, and I'm thinking about converting it to biodiesel. I just wanted to know if you knew what the process, if there's something I had to do with my vehicle to do that, and if there is there a way to find out where I can fill up with diesel fuel, biodiesel fuel?
No.
Okay, I don't, I guess, Mark, do you know what percentage you want to run? You want to run 100% biodiesel, or?
I guess I don't know what would be, I don't want to lose that much of my miles per gallon, and I don't know if the efficiency on biodiesel is worse or better.
Yeah, okay.
So first off, there is a co-op on, I want to say, Willie Street, I want to think. It's on the east side of Madison that actually sells biodiesel. So that would be your location. I think they're selling, it may be 100%. Most of the foreign companies, or I'll say European manufacturers of diesels, have tested their engines up to 50% biodiesel. And they're pretty confident they could run at that level. Most of them are only warranting their engines up to 20% biodiesel use.
Okay.
So, I mean, it depends. It's your call as to what you want to. If you have an older vehicle,
it's a 2004.
Yeah, you know, if you've got 200,000 miles on it, then probably at that point, if you want to convert over, they're really it's only about a 5% energy loss because of the oxygen on board. It's a very low amount of oxygen compared to like an ethanol blend, so you shouldn't see much in the realm of decrease in power out of the vehicle. And what the biodiesel is it actually it's the fuel system, the elastomers and the polymers used in there are the ones you have to worry about, because the natural base is actually, I mean, one of the byproducts you use is lye. So you basically make soap out of this, the byproduct of the stuff. And so it's a very good detergent. And so because of that, sometimes some of the components they use in the system aren't designed for that high a level. And you know, so 10 years from now, if you started running 100% biodiesel, 5 or 10 years, you might have a problem. If you think you're only going to use a car for another 3 years, you probably won't see an issue with it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Dan in Appleton, we're on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
So, listen, I've been doing a lot of research on the internet about HHO generators. Have you heard anything about that?
What is it? HHO?
Yeah, HHO generators. What it basically is an electrolysis process that creates hydrogen and two hydrogen and one oxygen, which gives you HHO, and then you induce the gas that's produced by the generator into your carburetor, and it's supposed to improve your gas mileage by like up to 8 to 10%, depending on the quality and the type of HHO generator that you've built. And there's a tremendous amount of information on the internet about these systems that introduce this gas into your carburetor, meaning that you don't have to convert anything.
Yeah, well, I want to give. Are you familiar with what we're talking about here, Glenn?
Yes, I've heard quite a bit about these, and it's one of those situations where if you get the right vehicle and you put it on there, you may see a fairly large increase in the fuel economy. And so the question is, and if you look at most of these studies, typically these are not 2008, 2009, 2010 model year cars that they're seeing these large improvements on. A lot of times they're looking at early 90 cars that they'll do the conversions on. And the newer cars are very sophisticated, and they change the engine operating conditions to stay so that to have the emissions very clean, you have to basically be monitoring the engine at all times, and you have to actively change the amount of fuel or the spark or and all those things basically so that the emissions are all the time clean up to the California standards. And so what happens in the early 90s is we didn't have all the sophistication. We kind of just ran the engine in a normal mode. And if you introduce the hydrogen into the intake system, what you could do then is you're basically tricking the engine as to how it was operated. The hydrogen itself, the nuance is you have to take the power off of the battery to create the hydrogen and the oxygen. And so your generator off the engine has to create that energy. So it's not just free energy you're getting. You're actually having to run your engine, has to put out more power because it's like having the headlights on all the time.
Okay.
To create this hydrogen and this oxygen. And so most of the things I've seen is that the people that are seeing bigger gains are the ones that are, the older vehicles, the older engines that don't have the newer emissions equipment on it. And to this end, we're actually going to be this fall doing a project with Beloit. They actually have one on one of their older diesel trucks, and they're seeing some fairly large fuel economy increases that they're claiming with it. And so here again, in certain cases, if they idle a lot, it may be that it does become more efficient. But it's not, and if you're just going to be cruising down the highway at 60 miles an hour, it's probably not going to be a net efficiency gain because the alternator in your vehicle is like 40% efficient.
Glenn Bauer, our guest today as we talk hybrid vehicles, diesel, and other fuel technologies here on the Ideas Network. Talking hybrid vehicles, diesel, and fuel technologies now with Glenn Bauer, senior scientist in mechanical engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Larry Mueller here with you, and give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. And Glenn, we've had Marie from Appleton waiting for quite a while, so let's just go right to the phones here. Marie, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. My neighbor parked his hybrid in a parking lot. The next a person sees the car is moving, and he stopped it.
Hmm. So how did that happen?
I'm calling you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So your question is how did that happen?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Glenn, how would that happen? Do you remember? Do you know what kind it was? Was it a Toyota? Was it a
no?
Honda?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know. Okay.
Okay. This issue comes up a lot with the fire departments and the EMS, and I've been a volunteer actually on ambulance service for 20 years. So we've been retraining actually the emergency personnel and how to do this. And that is that with these vehicles, most of them, they have an electric mode at very low speeds. So even though you park it, when you stop, there's nothing running. There's nothing making noise. So you don't think it's actually. And so probably in this case, what happened is the person just didn't shut the vehicle off and put it in park. So I'm guessing since there's no accelerator input, it shouldn't have been running the electric motor to power it, but it probably just was. It was like you leaving your car in neutral.
Yeah.
On a slight slope. And so basically it starts rolling. And so that would be what my premise would have happened in this case.
Yeah, I think with the Toyota, you have to push the – there's two buttons you have to push kind of to turn the thing off because you don't have a key. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a key, but you don't have it plugged into anything. It's in your pocket.
Yeah.
Key's in the pocket, so you have to hit park and then hit off. Otherwise, it's – still on.
Yes, that's correct. And so that's what we have to train everybody to, is that even though if you get up on a scene and it's a hybrid, you can't assume that it's not going to run you over if somebody bumps the gas pedal or something.
Yeah. All right. So there you have it, Marie. Marge in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Marge.
Hi there. I'm on the cusp of buying a used compressed natural gas Honda Civic, and it's very interesting. I don't know what kinds of questions to ask about a CNG car. How does it differ from buying a used Honda Civic? And then once I purchase it, if I decide to go ahead and do it, am I beholden to Honda dealerships to fix my vehicle in the Milwaukee area, or are there resources of the mechanics that work with alternative fuel cars?
Okay, so my first question would be is whether this was CNG from Honda directly, or if somebody actually bought a retrofit kit from like a company in the United States to put on there.
It's direct, and it's a New York fleet car.
Okay, then the question is I would contact a local dealership and see if they have anybody trained that can even service this vehicle, because this happens a lot with the car companies. They will release a limited fleet of vehicles in a certain area, and usually it's New York, Washington, D.C., or California, and it is a political statement. General Motors just did this with their fuel cell Equinoxes. And so what's happening then is that the trained people are only in very specific areas because that's the only area they'll be used in. And so in this case, I would be cautious as to whether there are a large dealership in Wisconsin that has anybody trained to service this vehicle.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's see. Will driving Steve emailed, will driving in the daytime with lights on cost fuel economy?
Yes, it will. Mm. So it's not a huge amount. You're talking about like 100 watts. So just to give you a synopsis, you're probably, when you're cruising, you're probably using 3 or 4 kilowatts. So that would be 2%, one or 2% of what you're actually using to cruise on the highway at like 55 miles an hour.
Okay. And someone mentioned that Prairie Biofuel, something on a place we were talking about earlier, has moved to North Stoughton Road in Madison. So that's Prairie Biofuels. Is on North Stoughton Road in Madison. And then another caller asked if you can make sure, if you can make more gas from a barrel of crude than you can make diesel from a barrel of crude, wouldn't it be in the country's best interest to use gas rather than diesel?
So this is not an easy question. I'll take a shot at it. So we've been using the easier crude to refine for the last, I want to say, 30 or 40 years. So now what's happening is we're getting the stuff that has more sulfur, more contaminants, we'll call it, in it, dissolved into it that we have to remove. Typically, what you're basically doing is you're actually boiling the crude oil.
No.
And then what you do is it's like condensing. You actually condense at different temperatures in this column then, and you extract off what will basically condense at those temperatures. So you have kind of the gas spectrum, and then below it is the diesel's a little bit heavier, comes off below it. And so typically you get about the same amount, if you just took it straight off, you get about the same amount of gasoline as you would diesel fuel out of the regular crude oil. And so what you can do then is if you run it through catalyst, you can crack it. We call it cracking. So you get it hot, run it through a catalyst, you can crack it in half. And then so there what you can do is you can convert the diesel fuel, those longer chains into the shorter chains, which then are gasoline. unfortunately, this costs you money because you have another process you have to run. And so in Europe, they use more diesel fuel than they use gasoline. In the United States, we use more gasoline than we use diesel fuel as far as to what comes in the crude oil. And so you're, you know, in the end, I think there are some tankers running from Europe to here with just gasoline, and there's diesel tankers from here running back there with diesel fuel. So,
oh, boy. Dwayne in Chippewa Falls, we're on to you now. Hi, Dwayne.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
basically, just on fuel economy. Is ethanol, is it actually beneficial for the economy to do the ethanol? And then the study I read about is if you can get the non-ethanol gas in the additive of acetone. Have you ever had any information on that?
Okay.
Okay, the first part, the ethanol. I can address that one. I haven't researched anything on adding acetone into your gasoline. Acetone is used a lot in the labs, chemistry labs and such, as a cleanser. And so I would be a little precautious as to how much I put in the gasoline. Because you have to, your injectors and stuff in your vehicles have to be lubricated, and that comes through the additive package that's in the regular gasoline. As far as the ethanol is itself, it is an alcohol, and so it has some oxygen on board. And so the question is, in the end, if you look at the energy content of what's in a gallon of ethanol versus what's in a gallon of gasoline, if you look at the energy conversion to mechanical energy, it's about the same. It's just that ethanol has less in it to start with because it's a different chemical compound. So what we're looking at then is how much dependence do you want on foreign oil, and how much can we actually look at in the United States as being that we can do with making ethanol. And so there's some actually newer technology coming up with the ethanol, and it's the cellulosic production of ethanol. And so we're using enzymes to convert starches into sugars, which then can be fermented and then used in a distillation process. These actually are using very low amounts of energy input relative to the conventional, you just take corn and create alcohol from it, from the corn base. And the one thing that I've been talking to people is that they're actually using corn cobs. Corn cobs actually have a very high sugar content.
Mm.
And so what they're looking at is using something that's just wasted back into the field, collecting it, transporting it to a local ethanol plant, and then using it to create the ethanol. And so with these newer technologies that are available, the ethanol is basically, we're going to be putting less like energy into it to create the same amount, to gain a lot more energy out with the ethanol.
That's really pretty cool. So, and a lot of research going on in the College of Ag and Life Sciences and College of Engineering on that very thing right here.
We've actually got a very large research facility for that here.
Very large. Let's go to Al in Appleton next. Al, hello to you.
Hello. Hi, I was just wondering if there was a particular make and model of hybrid, whether he would recommend to purchase. I believe there's a third generation Prius. At least that's what's advertised. Just wondering if there was a particular make and model that you thought was maybe better than another brand.
Yeah.
I guess... one of the questions to you would be, is how many family members you have and how large a vehicle you want. I guess that would be one of my driving factors. Currently, I think that what I looked at is that most of the hybrids are using the exact same powertrain layout. And so in the end, you're going to, regardless of which one you use, you're actually going to get, the same performance and the same longevity out of basically all of the hybrids that are out there. The Toyota is a little bit smaller than the new Ford Fusion that's available.
Oh.
And so I guess it's a matter of what comfort class you want in. Now, the Ford is unique in the fact that they've actually created, using their hybrid package, they're operating on a non-traditional cycle, which is called the Atkinson cycle. So they're basically over-expanding the exhaust products. And so they can actually gain efficiency from that. So if you actually look at the Fusion, they're actually one of the few hybrids that looks at having both a higher city and highway fuel economy number. If you look at most of the others, their highway fuel economy numbers are basically just about the same as their baseline models. And that's because on the highway, you're not using the electrical system. What you're doing is you're just using the engine to provide all the power. And so if you don't have a different engine that's a higher efficiency engine, there's no way to really increase that fuel economy.
Yeah, the new Toyota Prius has a different engine. You're right, it's that third generation, and mm-hmm. it's a little bigger engine, so they're getting better gas mileage than their, say, the 2009s, for example.
Yeah, and I wasn't able to see if the Toyota was doing that, like what Ford is doing, where they put a little bit bigger engine in. Because you're overexpanding it, you lose a bit of the power, so you have to increase the engine size a little bit, but you get better efficiency, the same power, yeah. and a higher fuel economy. But as far as most of these, ASIN is the company that's making the transaxle for them. So the transmission that has the electric motors built into it is being basically, there's one company that's building all the models for all the different companies. So.
And we looked at, we bought the Prius, but we looked at the Fusions and really liked the Fusions a lot. And frankly, a Toyota guy told me that. He thought the Fusions were very good. He liked the Fusions a lot, too. As it turned out, it was a comfort issue for my wife because of the seat situation. So we wound up not buying that one and the Fusion and buying a Prius.
Yeah, I actually have, let's say, four or five alumni that actually are the calibrators and engineers on the Fusion. And when they made the first round of the Ford would be Escape hybrid, they cut a lot of the things out that they wanted to do for cost measures. And what they did is when they went back and did their second generation hybrid, they kept every feature that they had on the chalkboard. And so what they're doing then is they came up with this vehicle that is getting basically very, very good fuel economy. And so there's this, if you listen to the commercials, right? They're saying the Fusion has the best sedan fuel economy in the United States. Well, the Toyota Prius is a hatchback, and so it doesn't classify as just a sedan. So there's some splitting of hairs on the advertising there.
Yeah. So there you have it, Al.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I did like those Fusions. They were nice cars. Mike in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have a 2001 Beetle that is a diesel, and I've been reading about semi-tractor trucks that are going to have these engines that need to burn low sulfur. And I'm wondering, is that going to be something that's going to be down the road affecting where I can get diesel, or is my diesel bug going to be able to run on whatever is available at the stations?
The first comment is that we've actually gone to a lot lower sulfur level in the diesel fuel already, and that happened, I can't remember, it was early 2000. So we went from like a 500 ppm level to below a 50 ppm level. And in California, if the way the regulations work, you can actually buy down. You have to have a certain blend of aromatics and olefins, big words. Yeah. Anyway, so basically in California, they're using probably 10 to 15% or 10 to 15 ppm sulfur because they have extra desulfification capability, and then they don't have to do this fractionation of the fuel. So in the end, what's going to happen is the companies have to put in a lubricity additive, and that is really your only issue with lower sulfur. Sulfur was basically what was lubricating the fuel injection system. And so when you're running these fuel pumps in, up to 20, 25,000, and the newer ones are even 30,000 PSI, you need to have some good lubricating properties with the fuel. So you shouldn't have any problems. And the reason they're taking the sulfur out is that the particulate traps and the emissions catalyst that they're putting on board is once a piece of sulfur gets on that, it basically attaches itself permanently to the catalyst, and it creates it and activates that site. And so if you're looking at having to meet emission regulations for 200,000 miles, you have to take the sulfur out. there's no way we can get around that.
No way to get around that.
This is one of these where the fuel companies and the catalyst companies, the automotive companies, have to work together, or there's no way we can meet a new lower emissions target.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. John wonders if there are plans to add noise to the Prius when running on the electric motor.
I guess I can't answer that one for you. This is a problem that we have. And we do this in our competitions, though, is that everybody grades how good a hybrid is relative to how well it matches what customers like in a normal vehicle. And we're not to the point of developing a new set of standards that hybrid customers are wanting in their hybrids. That's one of those points. And I did read that the Fusion actually, they can do up to 47 miles per hour in electric mode. So now you're getting fairly high speeds with a very quiet vehicle.
Yeah, I think the Prius is only about 37 or 36 or 37.
Yeah, and so we've seen this with the electric snowmobile too, that in the snow it just muffles the noise, and you literally could run somebody over without from the backside before they even knew you were coming. So yes, it is a concern.
And Matt in Green Bay, we on to you now. Thanks, Matt, for calling.
Hey, guys. Driving around in my 2008 Toyota Prius, loving every minute of it. Second one I bought. Great deal. Question for you. Why aren't they going to a completely new design change on hybrid vehicles? And by that, I mean, why don't they go with a 100% electric drive system with a hyper-tuned gasoline engine? That just really, the gasoline engine would only produce electricity, like a generator, plain and simple. And that could be turned into a natural gas-driven engine or whatever, but you can hyper-tune a gas engine without having the gas engine idling up and down and really trying to push a vehicle along. Why haven't they gone to a full 100% electric drive system and get rid of the mechanical linkages?
Okay, what you've described to me is the Chevy Volt. Yeah. And that's, in essence, what the Chevy Volt will be. Most of the plug-in hybrids that will be coming out will be using that kind of architecture where basically you have an electric motor that's large enough to propel the vehicle, and then the range you get will be how much money or how much space you get for the batteries, and then you'll have this auxiliary power generation unit on board, and it can be a fuel cell that creates electricity directly. It could be a hydrogen-powered engine that drives a generator. It could be a CNG powered, could be a gasoline powered, could be a diesel powered engine driving a generator. But
let me just interrupt. They're still using a mechanical linkage to drive the vehicle, if I'm correct, right, on the Chevy Volt?
I've seen a couple different versions, but to my knowledge, it's an electric drive to the wheels, and then there's just basically a generator set that basically recharges the batteries on board. Now, with most of the hybrids, like the Ford Fusion and the Toyota Prius, with the transmission that they have, they have the ability to operate the engine in a more efficient zone because you're balancing the speed of the wheels, an electric motor, and the engine. And so if you're at a lower efficiency point than you want to be, what you can do is you can increase the speed of the engine to a more efficient point. And then what you do is you take the excess power with the motor that's balancing this, and you create electricity with it, and you can drive the wheels. And so what you're doing in the Prius then is you're having, in these times when you're in a very low efficient point, if you're just driving the engine, you increase the speed, you basically power generate electricity, store it in the battery pack, and then you shut the engine off.
Yeah.
And then you run electric mode for a while, and then when the batteries get down a little bit lower, you turn it back on. So the Prius and the Fusion and those are kind of a pseudo halfway there, what you're talking about, Matt. And yes, you're correct. Once you run one load point on a generator, then you can spend a lot of time tuning it and making it efficient and making it very clean at that point.
Right. You use the batteries as a buffer for the draw or the recharge. And really all you're doing is recharging a battery pack and keeping that in its perfect band, so to speak, so you don't burn up the batteries. But as far as I know, I don't think anybody's made the leap yet, and I wonder what is the factor that's keeping that from happening.
Cost. the large battery packs cost a lot of money, and so that's kind of the short answer for you. And so some of the newer studies that are out there is we're actually looking at what it costs as far as energy to mine the nickel, to mine the different components that actually go in the batteries, and to figure out that if you start putting too much energy into making the vehicle, then and it only runs 100,000 miles, The energy you save, the 100,000 miles it operates, may not offset the fact that you spent too much energy trying to get some rare earth metal to make the battery pack more efficient. And so, that, I mean, so we're actually looking at kind of a global sense of all, where all the energies are being applied in these manufacturing of these vehicles.
Man. You guys have a website, by the way, with your system there, with your car system and your vehicle system
I'll
there?
I'll have to look it up for you. I don't have it right off.
while he's looking that up, I want to remind you, Glenn Bauer is senior scientist in mechanical engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Engineering, and really pleased to have him back. I hope we'll come back again and we'll talk with him again some more about hybrid vehicles, diesel, and fuel technologies. He works with the teams of UW students, and they've got a website, and he may or may not have that website up.
Yeah, I think I got it here. It's www.engr.wisc.edu/student.orgs, so studentorgs/vehicle.
All right. Glenn, you'll come back?
Sure.
Glad to have you back again. And he will be back. And just to let you know, tomorrow, Frank Armstrong, co-author of Save Your Retirement, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. Lots in store.